Caught Offside with Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney.
Winds of change are blowing. There's excitement in the air. Can you feel it? It's electric and magical. The happy train's on track. Because America is back!
There's Dan again. It's open now. Oh, there's the second goal. And a special moment for Christian Ramirez.
America is back. America
Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Oh, that is wonderful. What a patriotic start to the show.
Yeah, you like that?
America's back.
It sure is. Thanks to South Park. That's what that song is from, in case you weren't sure.
Thanks to Jordy Mihailovic.
Yeah, among others. Oh, what a fun night. It's back.
It's kind of back. It's not really back.
And we're going to talk all about whether or not it's back. The Bearhalter era underway. We'll get into that. We've got a big recap, JJ, of, yeah, the FA Cup fourth round.
It was actually a good fourth round weekend.
Yeah, I know. And certain TV ratings reflected that, which we will discuss as well. Red card, man of the match, a little small what to watch for, because it is an EPL midweek week.
Pretty important one.
Which is why we're here on a Monday, and then we'll be here again on a Wednesday.
Because of our commitment to you, the listener.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Also, we have no lives.
That's sad. Oh, boy. Should we talk about the U.S.?
We should talk about it because...
Have you ever seen such... Look at the notes that I kept for such a whatever game.
Rigorous.
Yeah.
There are more characters on Andrew's page of notes of analysis from this game than there were human beings in the stadium last night.
That is sadly close to being true. JJ, there was roughly, what would we say, like 7,000 or so. I didn't see the exact number, but that's what was being talked about, I think, beforehand.
Yeah, about 7,000. Now, the American Outlaws congregating together, of course, US Soccer did the best to put a happy face on this, and in their social media tweeted the behind the goal view, which makes it look like, oh my God, what an atmosphere, what a win, we're back. Yeah. But it was disappointing, and Mark Fishkin, who is a Red Bull New York tweeter and a man who does a podcast called Seeing Red, but he's a good solid US soccer man of many years standing, made the point last night that the non-qualification for the World Cup has just had such a detrimental effect, and it's part of Bearhalter's remit to re-energize the fan base, the casual fan base. And I would agree with that, even if this was, let's be honest, this shouldn't really get full international caps. It's a...
Well, that's the thing, is like you're saying, and you're right, I do believe that...
It's a scrimmage.
It is a scrimmage. And what you say is true. Not qualifying for the World Cup has hurt like general interest in this phase, I think, from the casual American soccer fan. They kind of are in the phase of wake me up when it's time to really do this again.
Yeah, you got to tell them when to care.
And honestly, it's hard for me to blame them for that. You know, going into these games, okay, well, at least maybe I'll see Pulisic. Oh, wait, no, he's not going to play. Oh, well, Josh Sargent's been really exciting he's not going to play. Like, you know, going into this, that it's going to be not a B team. This is like C, borderline D team for the U.S. And like, it's hard to get people really excited about going to see that game.
And don't forget that the American sports fan base and the American soccer base is no different to anything else. You've got the hardcore group, which we'll say are between 15% and 20%. Then you've got another 20% who are soccer fans, good stout soccer fans, but you've got vast swathes of people who are event junkies, and you got to give them something. So, you know, Donna on Long Island, who only tunes in for World Cup and if there's a game on TV, that, you know, she's very casual. Or how about Greg on Long Island as well? So these fans, they're like, is Pulisic playing? Oh, he's not? Oh, okay.
Right. But here's the thing, though. You say you got to give them something. Well, it's not really their job to, like, it's their job to build this team in the way that suits them. It's not their job to put on a spectacle.
The value for Greg Bearhalter and US soccer is the basically the culture he's creating in this week with these players, mm-hmm. the time in camp together, and him yeah. getting his feet under the table. That's it.
Yeah. The only other thing I would say about it, though, is that, look, the people running U.S. soccer, you know, they're not dumb. They understand the situation. They probably understood going into this that attendance would be low. That would have looked, I mean, last night, attendance-wise, would have looked bad in any stadium. But it looks embarrassingly bad in that stadium. There are soccer-specific stadiums sprouting up all over the country. Why are they playing a January camp friendly against Panama in a stadium that seats 80,000 people? It looks terrible.
It does look terrible. Also, ticket pricing is a problem. So many people tweeting screenshots trying to get tickets lower than $30. Now, for me and you, all right, we might go to $30 for a game like mm-hmm. that. But even us, on our own going to the game, are going to be, geez, I don't.
Well, we live in a world now where you can't really see any game of significance for much less than that.
Read the room, Andrew. Read the room.
What room?
Seriously.
There wasn't anything to read.
But I would have said, knock it down, make them 15, 20. Because don't forget, kids and families can fill the stadium. Mm-hmm. $120 if you're bringing four people, like, come on.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, now I've never been there, but from what I hear about Glendale, where that game was played, it's not really near much. Like, so it's not from, you're starting at a place that's inconvenient yeah. for most people to get to. And then, I don't know. But that's all kind of side notes to what actually matters, and that is this team.
And what a game.
Well, look, here's the things that I think are important to remember and to kind of focus on when looking at this game yesterday. Yes, it is a glorified scrimmage, but you could look at it and see what it is this guy is trying to do. By this guy, I mean Greg Berhalter. Like, you can... You know,
could you?
Well, I thought so. I mean, there were moments where he applied the press, and I thought when he did, I thought there were moments when it worked and yeah. it seemed effective. But more so than that, I thought you could really tell, you know, he's all about spacing. Well, you know, how wide was Jeremy Abobase on the left? Like, he was as wide... Like, you could see, okay, they are clearly trying to space the field. And, you know, the way that they kind of had it set up, pass through the midfield, Michael Bradley with, like, bang, bing, bong, boom, crisp, like, 15-yard passes here, there. Like, it's just, you know, get it out wide. He wants his wide players getting in behind the defense. They're making runs
that
and,
came
and playing
through,
that ball in.
That came through very strongly, and you couldn't help but, you couldn't argue that it wasn't successful, and it was very good. The problem for me was Panama were so submissive. They were dropping off. Bradley had a brilliant game because he could have a brilliant game. He was not pressed or pressured or harried
yeah,
once.
Yeah, but in some ways I almost like the fact that Panama is playing that many guys behind the ball, because I want it to be tougher for the U.S. in games of no significance like this to try to find their way through. Like, these are a lot of the games that they're going to play in CONCACAF will resemble that. Panama's a CONCACAF team. So,
they are, Andrew. They're a CONCACAF team that had two members of the World Cup squad present in last night's.
See, teams all around.
Got to be, you know, added into the equation. I saw certain things I liked, but I didn't think it was any more sophisticated than getting good, as you said, spacings, good positions, good numbers up in areas, in wide areas where you can attack. And we saw some excellent crosses coming in at times. Jossie Zardes on another night could have had a hat trick. So you can't say he wasn't served very well. But yeah, it was a weird game for me. It's obviously a team that hasn't played together. You're putting together disparate parts, like Jossie Zardes and Mihailovic up front together. You're reshaping and reforming the midfield. And the only thing that I would say was Michael Bradley was in a position that he would absolutely adore to be in.
Yeah.
In where he is almost the pivot point there, getting on the ball, pinging it wide to players. And also, Andrew, he was the outlet ball every single time. He was the outlet ball, and it helped him too that Panama applied no pressure to him.
Yeah, he's the one guy last night, because, like, when you look around the field at who was playing for the U.S., there were a lot of new names, there were a lot of MLS names, a lot of names that more likely than not will be replaced by some of these European guys that we just mentioned, McKinney, Adams, Pulisic. So, you know, it's good to be able to fill out a roster. It's good for depth. I love seeing, you know, Christian Ramirez come on, score a goal. Mihailovic, he played well, no question about it. I thought Corey Baird, I thought, looked really good. So that is important. But more than any of those guys, with the exception of Zach Steffen, Bradley is the only other player who was out there last night that I, you know, who has been a fixture of the U.S. and who may have a role for them going forward, like a serious role for them going forward. And I know how that bothers people, but you know, he played well. Like, I don't know, you know, people want to fight that notion, but he did. He had a good game. And like you said, the role that they found for him, I thought was good. And like, it's okay. You know, I can think that and people on Twitter can think that and whatever are what we think means nothing. But this is from Bearhalter, the guy who is now analyzing all these people. He said, it's hard for me to understand how people gather that opinion, a negative one of Bradley, because when I see him up close, it's clear he has quality. When you look at his quality level in this group, it's high. His leadership has been good. His execution has been excellent. And that was before last night's game.
Ian McKenzie Archibald tweeted us, this is weird to say, but I like Michael Bradley tonight. It's not weird to say.
It's okay to like there him, was people. Mass, you don't have to hate him.
There was mass confusion on Twitter, which makes me wonder. You know the way we talk about educated soccer fan bases? And I think actually in this country, we, despite what certain people around the world think of us in terms of soccer, this is actually quite an educated fan base and a fan base that's learning at an exponential rate because they're being exposed to so much. But one thing that is almost schizophrenic is people on Twitter last night, I hate saying it, but Bradley actually played well.
Why do you hate saying it?
First of all, why do you hate saying it? Second of all, recognize that he was put in a position to absolutely succeed by the ineptitude of the opposition, but also by the positioning of the manager. This is a role that he can absolutely do. I honestly don't think there's much point talking about Michael Bradley at all in the context of this game, except that the manager thinks he has quality. Okay, he showed quality last night in an unpressurized situation. As we move forward, we'll have to see if he's still got that in his locker. It's almost like making an argument about a game that's been before. You know, we're reaching back to bad Bradley games to try and reimagine what happened last night. Someone asked me, what do you think of Michael Bradley? Thought he had a good game. Oh, you think he's definitely going to start now in the Gold Cup? Don't know.
Yeah. People, when talking about him, we have to make these leaps.
We have to have judgments, and that's just not a game. By the way, he came off the field. He just seemed nonplussed by the whole occasion, and I think
he knows he's been through this before. He knows what these games are.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the fans, are allegedly educated fans, need to know what these games
are.
Well,
look, I'm not going to get on the fans entirely.
No, it wasn't
for
just
that
the fans, because there were some other people tweeting about it too.
No, but I'm just saying that like that's not something unique to American soccer fans. There's polarizing opinions about key players in countries all around the world.
But they know what this is. They know what last night was.
But I'm saying, look, we talk all the time about how Raheem Sterling is a great player. But in England, you talk to 10 people, you get 5 people that might think he's garbage.
I just can't believe last night elicited anything other than I thought Bradley was okay.
Well, it's funny. We're going to do a little bit of masterpiece theater here, because Yves Galarsep had a tweet, I thought, this morning that just absolutely pinpoint nailed the way the American soccer fan feels about Michael Bradley. He says this is USMNT in a nutshell. And basically he has a tweet from somebody, like a token tweet from somebody, and then a token response. Read the first part and I'll read the second part.
Jordi Mihailovic looked amazing.
I know, he could be the 10 we need.
And how about Nick Lima? He could push Yedlin for the right back spot.
Absolutely.
And Michael Bradley was class.
Settle down, it was Panama's C team.
That is fair.
It's so true.
And that's in response to a tweet he had put out before, which he talked about Bradley in very effusive terms. And I knew the minute he sent that, you have not added nearly enough nuance in your tweet. You literally have to explain. If I was to tweet last night, I thought Bradley was excellent, I would need to put an asterisk and then put a tweet disclaimer on the other side of it saying, we understand that Michael Bradley was good in this game, but this was Panama's C team.
Right.
Results may vary.
Right, but it is true. Like, that didn't matter for when Nick Lima made the play, the Wayne Rooney play of the game, the slide tackle, dribble the ball in, centers it, goal for Zimmerman. You know, like, people were losing their minds. And it was a great play by him.
Michael Bradley, as a player, is a U.S. drug commercial advert for, we'll say, flatulence. Right? So what happens in a U.S. drug advert is what? We see Imagine a guy walking on the beach, wonderful hair, muscles. I struggled with flatulence for many, many years until I found Zanotapron. Zanotapron sorted out my flatulence. And you're like, yes, Zanotapron, awesome. And then it just shows him walking further down the beach, probably playing with a dog. And the next thing you hear is, Zanotapron may not work for everyone. Michael Bradley may cause further flatulence, loss of anus. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You have to constantly put in context Bradley for these fans who just want to crush him.
And by the way, I think Berhalter, like, this is kind of, you know, he has a lot of challenges coming in here. He has to fix what was kind of a broken system. Yeah, but one thing that is really difficult for a manager or a coach in any sport is to take what was once a great player, and yes, I will put Bradley into that group when we're talking in U.S. soccer terminology, and how to kind of maneuver that player into the latter phase of his career. That's a really hard thing to do. I know the Yankees struggle with it with Derek Jeter. Like, that's, you know, you just see that across all sports.
But you also hear people as well who talk about his potential replacements, and they're, he won't work. Can't do him.
But I think Berhalter has actually gotten off to a good start with this. He's keeping Bradley around because he recognizes that there is value there to what he can bring. But, you know, he's also careful to just, like, ignore everything that people seem to say and feel about. Like, he didn't give Bradley the captain's armband, which I thought, honestly, was appropriate.
I took pressure off him, too. It was wise.
Yeah, and Bradley talked about that afterwards. He said, whether I'm the captain, I'm not the captain, I wear the armband, I don't wear the armband, these things aren't important. It's about the team. It's about having a group of guys who understand what it's like to be all in on something together. And he goes on. And I think, you know, Berhalter, his decision, was the right one. And I think Bradley handled it in a normal way. Like, I don't know.
Bradley also suffers from something that's really beyond his control. I don't know, have you noticed this? You've watched Michael Bradley for years.
Mm-hmm.
He's not Tyler Adams. And he's not Weston McKennie. And these are the soup du jour. These are the guys of the moment.
Yeah.
And US soccer fans do not want to hear about Michael Bradley or even like Will Trapp coming into that midfield. They want those two guys in there come hell or high water. Even if it might be a Lampard-Gerrard thing, kind of a, you know, an oil and vinegar, it won't mix.
Be honest with me for one second.
What?
I know you make fun of it, but deep down inside, you wish the Gold Cup started tomorrow, don't you? I want it to happen now.
Yeah,
I want to see like the actual,
yeah,
all of this. Like,
I agree with
the
you.
Whole Sarakhan run of, oh, this is fun, but like, who are these guys? What are they really going to mean to us? Now it's January camp and it's like, oh, well, what is this? Like, I so badly want to look at a team out there and say, yes, that is our 11. Now let's like move forward and know this. Like, we still don't know any. Who are the center backs for this team?
But I know, but I am so with you, and that's why I texted you last night. I was like, this game sucks. And it's not because the game was particularly bad. It was because, and there were some moments, it was because I know nothing after it. I'm taking an hour and a half out. There's nobody there. It's not even half a squad. It's a C squad.
Yeah.
We've got so many of our most talented players not there, and the Gold Cup might as well be next year. It's so far away. That's how it feels.
I know. It does. And I need it now. The center back thing, though, is interesting to me because they were talking about that a little bit on the broadcast last night. And I do feel like we're in this time right now where I've always had a fairly good sense of who that pairing will be, if it even is a pairing. If they're going to go with this back three, then we're talking about another piece. But, you know, in terms of center back pairings, I really feel like I if the Gold Cup did start tomorrow and you asked me to list my team sheet, I don't have a clue in hell who would be lining up in the back.
There's form and injuries and, well, it's worth mentioning Matt Miazga is at Reading now. Me and you had him penciled in. We really liked the way he was playing when he was in the Eredivisie. And
we think John Brooks is still, we think he's still a lockdown first team starter.
We do, but he's often looked shorn of his domestic abilities.
It's like I haven't seen him play for the U.S.
Right.
in years.
So we don't know. We actually know probably more about our fullbacks than we do about our center backs. But again, we don't know if he's...
Do we? Is Fabian Johnson still on this team?
I don't know. Is he retired?
I don't know.
Yeah. And we don't know if he's going to go with three at the back. Maybe he will prefer three at the back with wingbacks.
You know, one thing last night that you kind of, and rightfully so, I don't mean to mock you, but one thing that you kind of like rolled your eyes at when Berhalter was talking about it, they played out of the back last night, and they like actually did it. Like they really looked like they knew what they were doing.
Oh, Panama C team.
No, Andrew, Panama was a low press in that area. They didn't press them that hard. That's why
there was absolutely press at times when they were coming out from the back.
Was there?
Yeah. There definitely was.
Was there? Was it a coordinated?
I don't know. Like I wasn't in their team meeting.
I don't know. I didn't fit. Yeah.
They passed through it.
Hmm. So it's definitely the policy going forward now for everyone.
America is back. Okay.
Hey, guys.
If you learned anything last night.
I'm going to rock into the Azteca Stadium. I'm going to play that ball out from the back, baby.
I do keep wondering, though, like what will this team look like? Like, is Josh Sargent going to be their striker? Where will Pulisic play in this?
If I have my way, Josh Sargent will be the emperor. he's a wonderful man. He's a wonderful player.
There were times last night, specifically in the first half, around like the 10-minute mark, when the U.S. had those back-to-back possessions where Zardes had layoffs, one to Corey Baird. Were they both to Baird, or was the second one to... I forget who the second one was to, and both shots were shanked wide.
I think one was to Mihailovic.
Okay, and I just remember thinking each time, you know, no offense to Baird and Mihailovic, but I just remember thinking, oh, I can't wait for that to be Pulisic. You know, like I couldn't help but see the field and like see what they were doing in their build-up play and think like, oh, that will be even better when that guy's doing it.
And it might be Sargent making the layoff too.
Maybe, yeah.
We don't know. It's all up in the air, and we need the solidity and focus of a tournament.
I felt good, though, last night to kind of put a bow on this, seeing Berhalter on the sideline. Like, I don't know. People are really going to – American heads will explode if Michael Bradley turns out to still be good and Greg Berhalter turns out to be a really good manager, because the number of people that have crushed that appointment and the number of people that have written Bradley off as you know, Satan – like, what are they going to do if those guys turn out to be useful and good and talented?
Can I finish on a high note?
Yeah.
Nick Lima played as if there was 50,000 people there. It was a do-or-die, must-win game.
Good.
That tackle and the cross for Zimmerman for the second goal was awesome.
Yeah.
And that is what I liked. A guy who was up for it, wanted to take his chance, wanted to impress, was asked to do things that he even said he wasn't 100% comfortable with, but kind of assimilated into what Bearholder asked in terms of, you know, sometimes filling in and covering in the right back position. He looked good. He looked good. And the cross was excellent. Goalkeeping was not. And Zimmerman got that block of a head onto it. And it was good. The little things we plucked from it. By the way, what was also good was Zach Steffen's save at 1-0 in the 56th minute.
Yeah.
That was a brilliant save. And, little wonder Man City are looking at him or have signed
not
him.
Looking at him.
Yeah.
They've looked and they like what they saw.
Mm.
Yeah. Hey.
America is back!
That's right, everybody. We'll take a really quick break here. We're going to come back. We got some FA Cup to discuss. Lots of meaningful action in this tournament that just a couple weeks ago people decided they didn't care about anymore. I wonder if everyone still feels that way.
Oh, it was the January camp of cup competitions.
right. Yeah, red card man of the match. There's still so much to do. Don't go anywhere.
Good area. What a chance for Murray Wallace! And Millwall go to round five! Dolan's in the middle, it didn't come to him, it might come to Matt. It still might come for Dolan! There is your story! The former Middlesbrough youth player rescues a draw for Newport County!
Here is Traore, he delivers the cross and the header is in! And Wolves have saved themselves! Matt Doherty in the 93rd minute!
And Jan Speeden! And surely now, West Ham have beaten. Toby Civic just on as a substitute, the 19-year-old, with his first goal for AFC Wimbledon.
Ah, the magic. The magic of the cup, JJ.
Awesome.
You enjoyed that, right?
Europe.
Yeah.
What a band.
The Joe Bluth theme.
That's right.
He's a magician. That's why we did that. Oh, boy. So much to talk about, actually, which is not always a thing that we say after a non-EPL weekend.
Yeah, let's get to it. It was fun.
Yeah. I'll tell you what. Let's start with what I have termed to be the era of good feelings, and it continues now at Manchester United.
Now, I had not heard this phrase, the era of good feelings.
Yeah, you were ready to mock it.
I was. It sounded awkward and clunky and like something a non-English speaker might say, and my reaction to it was,
"You said it, friend."
Now, when I explained to you, I put you in your place earlier.
Oh,
but
my
I was historically,
which is rare.
But I was actually wrong. Now, I said, for some reason, I had it in my head that the era of good feelings was during Dwight Eisenhower's years in office, but I was wrong. It's the years that followed the War of 1812.
Oh, the era of good feelings.
It still counts.
Yeah, it does.
You were still wrong to have never heard of it.
I had not heard of it.
Apology accepted.
Apologize to America.
But nevertheless, it does seem now that that is kind of what we're witnessing in this little Solskjaer run that has gone on. People didn't really want to talk about it like that at first because of the competition that they were playing. And then even after they beat Tottenham, people were still hesitant to dive fully into that because Tottenham were really the better team in that game.
And because of Dave's saves.
Right. But I think you have to, you know, now they go to the Emirates in an FA Cup match that both teams went for, and they come out as deserving winners. And I think now it's kind of all happening at Old Trafford.
It is. They're playing in a manner that is full of confidence. And there's a snapshot for me from the game, and I'm wondering if you noticed it too, where the ball is out wide. It wasn't just a snapshot. It was the second goal, JJ. Or sorry, the opening goal. And the ball's on the right-hand side. And Ander Herrera gets it, passes inside. It's a lovely move. And Lukaku, who, let's be honest, hasn't had the best stretch for Manchester United.
No.
And it's just this perfect kind of feint where it looks as if, is he going to shoot? Is he going to dribble? And he slides this perfect pass into the path of the perfect run by Alexis Sanchez, who goes round the keeper and slots home expertly from a tight angle. Now, that's fine. Manchester United have scored amazing goals and very well orchestrated goals before. I stopped, Andrew, and I said, try and imagine that goal under Jose Mourinho. I couldn't do it. That's the kind of confidence and the kind of feel-good factor that the manager has brought to the team. Miguel Delaney makes some good points here in his piece for The Independent that I wanted to put to you. The debates against Solskjaer becoming permanent manager get knocked off with every game, just like the opposition. Most relevant about this, though, was how United beat Arsenal with a much more defined game plan, and that despite the fact Unai Emery has had so much more time in the job, the home side continued to look so chaotic, and sure, that chaos did mean that there was also some fortune to a slightly more haphazard win for Solskjaer, but there was still the sleek and polished design of the first two counter-attacking goals that were reminiscent of so many past strikes at this stadium for United. He's so right. I remember a game under Sir Alex Ferguson, and I believe it was either 2012 or 2013, at the Emirates, and it was those breakaway, swift counter-attacking goals. I think Rooney scored in one of the games. I'm like, that is the essence of what United used to be. Now, if Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has somehow transmitted that to his players, and these players are executing, that means if I'm Ed Woodward, who, let's remember, doesn't have a football interlocutor, he doesn't have someone else really in his ear that we know of, he's making the decisions, he may just decide, if it's not broken, don't try and fix it.
It does feel a little bit like Solskjaer. No, you're not crazy. We brought this up weeks ago before the Tottenham game had even happened as, you know, something to kind of keep an eye on. And people have laughed at the idea of Solskjaer being the manager, but Miguel Delaney's right. Like, I don't know. It's still so early. It's January. I mean, so what do we have? Like 4.5 months left still in the season, plus
yeah,
United in multiple other cup competitions. So who knows? If things go horribly wrong, like we can still, you know, change our minds. But as it looks right now, if he keeps playing has them playing at this rate, and he's clearly unlocked something that was there all along for them, you know, it's hard to say that he hasn't at least earned like serious consideration for this. And it's amazing too. Like Miguel brings up Solskjaer doing this in far less amount of time as what Unai Emery had. Like, it does now make you look at Emery and Maurizio Sarri a little bit differently. Because for so much of this season, what have we been saying about them? Well, it's not going to happen overnight. Sarri came in late. Unai Emery had a big task ahead of him. Well, okay, then what do you say about Solskjaer? Is he just like a magician? How's he been able to do it so quickly? He's making those guys look bad.
Now, for those who are still in the camp that look, and I'm still one foot in there, the camp that looks at someone like Pochettino and has seen what he's built in terms of a club over 5 years, we will probably point to February. All right, so the second week in February, Manchester United will host PSG. That's on the 12th. On the 17th, they'll have Chelsea in the fifth round of the FA Cup, followed by Liverpool, albeit at Old Trafford. And then, when they have that second leg in early March against PSG, that's followed by Arsenal away and Man City in the Manchester Derby at Old Trafford. Mm-hmm. That kind of month period is going to be absolutely huge for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
It's easy to forget that they were runner-up last year, and they did so in a time where we can now look at them and say they were probably miserable. Like, they weren't really enjoying their football. It was not what we're seeing now, necessarily. It was defense-minded, Mourinho tactics. So, like, there is a good team in there.
There is, and also, it's not like it was out-and-out possession. Arsenal controlled the ball for most of the game, but that's... United were always capable of being a team that could kill you. You could think you're on top and they could kill you. And that's exactly what happened. Look at the look at goal number two. Lacazette dispossessed in the United penalty area. Herrera gets it, then Shaw goes on this mazy 25-yard run, and the next pass, and United are in on goal. Lingard ended up finishing it expertly. But that's United, back to front. It doesn't always have to be we have all the ball, we dominate the opposition. It's about sleek attacking football and transitions. And I don't know what much we can say about it until he stops doing it. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has tapped into this.
I'll have slightly more on this match later.
Okay.
On a specific angle of it. JJ, if it's the era of good feelings at Manchester United, then what do we refer to what is happening at Everton right now?
The winter of discontent.
They lose to Millwall at the death. Everton led twice in this, but conceded an equalizer within minutes each time.
Yeah.
And then ultimately the final kick of the ball was a win for Millwall.
Three shots on target against a Millwall team that's hardly tearing up trees in the Championship. 19th in the Championship.
Oh my.
Going into the weekend.
Morale right now at Everton is very, very low. And so what do I do every once in a while when that happens? Well, I go out and I pound the pavement, as they say. I meet the people. Talk to the people.
Oh, you've
I've done it again.
You have.
Yeah, I sent it. So as we reference sometimes on this podcast, we have a few mutual friends who are diehards,
hardcore Everton fans.
Yeah. Yep. So I sent Jay.
Oh, Jay will be the voice of reason.
Jay Shafe and Doug.
Can I give you? Jay will be a reasoned, solid voice.
All right.
He will be, if he was a president, George Herbert Walker Bush. He will be a steady hand.
Okay. What will Doug be?
Doug will be, oh Lord. Doug will just be, burn it down!
Like the man standing on the corner.
Shrieking.
Like screaming about how the world is coming to an end.
Yeah.
Okay. And Shafe will just, what?
Shafe will just have an air of glumness about it, but will be fairly steady.
Yeah.
While all the while having the screensaver that he hates Liverpool.
So here's what I will tell you. They really all kind of had the measured tone, the Herbert Walker tone, as you say. Doug, and I'll just run through it quickly, because Doug especially, he basically sent me back a book. It's like he was sitting by his phone waiting for that message to come through.
You need cliff notes, Doug.
So and this isn't you and me. This are Everton supporters telling us what they think. Doug says the lack of a true striker hurts them right now. It's forcing Richarlison to play out of position,
okay,
which makes sense because it's kind of neutralizing a potentially great player that this team has. Awful in set-piece defending.
Yep.
And as you and I can attest to, because we did speak to Doug that day, he said the Liverpool loss was a tipping point for them.
Yeah, they were. They played quite well in that Liverpool game, and it's all right talking about tipping points, but I think the lack of creativity, like, Gylfi Sigurdsson is fine, but is he going to create and generate, as a 10, enough chances for Richarlison or for Sent Tosin or Dominic Calvert-Lewin. Like, all right.
These are people.
Right, they are people. Three shots on target would say no. And by the way, Michael Keane and Yerry Mina are physically imposing centre-backs. How on earth are they getting, is that defence getting so bullied on set pieces by a team that could be on its way to League One? I couldn't believe the lack of just kind of somebody taking charge back there on set pieces. And it's generated this debate amongst Everton fans on Twitter about zonal marking or man marking.
That was also brought up.
Wouldn't have mattered. I'm sorry, guys. It wouldn't have mattered. Nobody attacked the ball.
Yeah, Everton's defending has been bad now for a few years. And the names, like, and we're talking about some fairly impressive names. The managers have changed, personnel has changed, but for whatever reason, and I don't know, I don't say that I have the answers, that has not changed. Now, Doug also says that he believes the fan base is split, because I'm curious how much the people, Everton supporters, believe this is a Marco Silva issue and how much is this a personnel issue. He thinks right now it's 60-40 blame Silva.
Seems like that. I would say that despite the signings that have been made by the manager, and a couple of them have been loan signings, let's be honest, it's not as if he's got everything he's wanted. There's still too much of the previous regime. Like I said, Sigurdsson, Michael Keane at centre-back. I don't think that's ever going to work.
They've had three managers now in a fairly tight window. You know, how many of these guys are Koeman's guys? You know, how many of these are Silva's guys? How many different philosophies from last year are now being altered to this year? Like Shafei, when I asked him, he said, no camaraderie at the club, too much turnover, no identity.
Yeah.
Jay said a lost club, not relegation bound, but not going anywhere. You know, he thinks Koeman set them back years from a talent standpoint.
Right.
Doug reiterated just not enough cohesion, too many managers in too short a time. Jay saying it feels like a lost club. I would agree with that. It does feel like they're just kind of existing in this mid-table space, like where Stoke City were a couple years ago.
And so there was this thing back in the 90s, which was like the worst thing in car sales, is where you bought a car that was a crashed car. It was a number of different pieces. Do you know what I mean? It was like, they called them cut and shuts, and they were deadly dangerous. There were two parts of the same car, but they were different, the same model car, fused together, and they were so dangerous, and it was a real problem. Now, I'm not saying this is the same danger, but this is pieces of everything.
Yeah.
This is bits from Koeman. There's a little bit there from even Martinez, and now there's a little bit from Silva, but even those bits are, like, there's talk that they're going to lose Bernard now. And I mean, he hasn't.
Oh my God, he's only just gotten there.
He's barely got a run in the team. Yeah. A player I actually quite like. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it's a problem that's going to be solved quickly. It feels like this is a project. I would suggest that they not fire this manager.
What's to begin from that?
Like, let's allow. You know, who knows? Maybe that will end up being problematic. But
don't they say two summer windows?
I think that's fair. I mean, as long as he's keeping them like not in relegation danger, and I know that's setting a really low bar, but you know, if we keep hearing about too many ideas, not enough cohesion, well then let's have a manager and go with it, and let him bring in some of his players and trust that hiring was a good one.
I think so too, and that is the main concern. Is like, I watch them play, and I'm like, is this any better right now than it was under Koeman? No. But if someone asked me, how do Everton play? What's their style? What do they like to do? I don't know.
Yeah. JJ, AFC Wimbledon deal a hammer blow to Manuel Pellegrini and
West Ham. The Wombles of Wimbledon.
Unbelievable. Wimbledon are bottom of League One, the third tier of English football, but they were still good enough to cause Pellegrini to say that he was, quote, ashamed of his team.
Well, they were 3-0 down.
Yeah. They did fight back to 3-2, but then Wimbledon added a fourth.
Wimbledon had a cushion. Think of that.
You know, it's interesting because Pellegrini said this. He said, we talked before the game that this game happens a lot of the time where the team in the lower division beats the team, which is better because they play every ball as if it's their last ball of the game.
Right.
We didn't have that attitude. And when we could, we didn't try. I think attitude really, it really does matter. People want to talk about the changes that Pellegrini made to the lineup. You know, Felipe came on as a sub. You know, ordinarily, he'd be somebody that would be starting for West Ham. Obviously, there was no Marko Arnautović in the lineup for this. People can say that. I'm sorry. Like, that falls on deaf ears for me. Like I just said, Wimbledon are bottom of League One. I don't care who was starting for West Ham. They shouldn't be losing 4-2 to AFC Wimbledon.
Do you want to hear something that's more embarrassing? I was at home in September in Ireland, and in the early stages of the Carabao Cup, the League Cup, where did West Ham go? They went to play Wimbledon, at Wimbledon, and they beat them 3-1. And, okay, it required a long-range effort by one of the West Ham players. It wasn't a perfect performance, but Andrew, they were comfortably the better side. They had knowledge of Wimbledon. This isn't like when Newcastle went to Hereford in the 70s and didn't know anything about the other players and they came up with the big shock. They have loads of knowledge about what Wimbledon would do. They knew they'd be up for it. This is all on them. Now, the only thing I would say, the difference between the September game, a lot of the guys played in September that played again the other day, the only thing I would say was Declan Rice started in September, controlled the ball, his passing was very, very good. And for some reason, Pellegrini decided to rest him. I know he's a young player. Maybe that made a difference to the midfield. But they were, it's one player. They have more than enough talent out there to have won this game. Yeah. And honestly, if you look at the like of Wagstaff for Wimbledon, who had took his goals excellently, particularly the second one, which was flicked into the bottom corner, Wimbledon was just outmatched them in terms of desire. And West Ham were shambolic.
Yeah. JJ, a bad week for Spurs gets even worse. They lose 2-0 to Crystal Palace. Here's what Mauricio Pochettino said that is kind of making waves right now. He said, "We're going to create a debate that to win a trophy is going to help this club. I don't agree with that." Wow. "That only builds your ego. In reality, the most important thing is being consistently in the top four and playing in the Champions League."
See, I can make the argument for both, and I know what he's doing there. And it, like I'd say, and I'm going to bore people with this because we've been in this kind of gloom hole ever since last week with Spurs. Spurs are just an infinitely better club, better team than what I remember them as. But what do fans want? What do fans want to see? They want to see somebody hoisting a trophy. And so Pochettino can say this all he wants, but it's not going to change the fans' mind. And also, context is important. If they didn't have that midweek game in the League Cup, we would definitely be talking about this defeat to Crystal Palace in a different way. But it feels like blow after blow, coming back to back.
Yeah. There is, I follow a lot of Tottenham supporters on Twitter. I listen to Tottenham podcasts. I have my own feelings as a Tottenham fan. I can tell you right now, there is a war being waged among supporters of this club that are conflicted in how to feel about them. There is the segment of Tottenham's fan population that whenever anybody starts complaining or whining about, you know, "Oh, we lost to Chelsea again in the semifinals in the FA Cup," there's always some Tottenham fan there to say, "Oh, you're whining about that. You should remember what it was like in the 90s. You should be thrilled every single day to be a Tottenham fan in 2019. And then there's the Tottenham fans that are furious right now that they can't take that next step, that they haven't spent the money necessary to take that next step, that they always seem to, you know, I hate to use this word, but that they choke in these major situations. And if it happened once or twice, you say, okay, but I went through it, the laundry list on the last podcast of all the semifinals and finals they've gotten to in the last 9 years, since 2010, that they lose. There is a battle being fought between both sides. It's very fascinating to see. And look, I'm here to tell you that I don't mean to take like the chicken way out, but can't you all see that you're both right?
Yeah.
Like, can't, I know we hate, like, that doesn't make for good podcasting or hot taking, but you're both correct. Like, yes, Tottenham are extremely fortunate to have elevated themselves to the position that they're in now. Like, they are a member, like, I remember first getting into Tottenham, it was the big four. Spurs weren't a part of that. It was United, City weren't a part of that either. It was United, Liverpool, Arsenal, and Chelsea. Even Chelsea were relative newcomers to that idea, but Tottenham were nowhere near that. So yes, the fact that they've helped create a big six in English football, yeah, of course that's meaningful, and I'm grateful to be a Spurs fan every day. But these Tottenham fans trying to tell me that I'm, you know, an ingrate for being disappointed after loss in big games, you know, title challenges to Leicester City that go by the wayside, semifinal defeats to arch rivals like Chelsea that go down in defeat time and time again in cup competitions. Like, I'm allowed to be upset about that too. Both things can be true at the same time.
No, you've got to focus on when Tottenham were relegated in 1976-77.
It's. I mean, come on. Like, I understand. Yes, okay. You're trying to prove to me that you've been around through the hard times. I get that, and I respect.
Well, that is a badge of honor for fans.
No, I understand that, but like this idea that Tottenham fans, you know, from other supporters policing them, kind of almost saying that you can't be upset about this because you should only remember where we were 20 years ago. All right, I understand that. But this is where we are now. And, like, you want to win. You do want to win a trophy. That does mean something.
I tried to balance out both sides for Spurs fans.
Well, that is, I think that is correct.
But I always come back to this, and I don't want to go down this road again because we have covered it ad nauseum. I really do think that holding off on the stadium and ploughing everything in
with this
to football operations was the way to go.
All right. By the way, I'm curious for your thoughts on this Twitter exchange. This is just a guy, at Paul Lay 10.
Just a guy. Oh, I'm sorry. Is he not in the media?
So Andros Townsend scored this game.
Yeah.
And so this fan, I guess, at Paul Lay 10, tweeted at Andros Townsend. He says, at Andros Townsend's career at Spurs, played 50 times in 7 years. Last time was 3 years ago. They loaned him out 9 times. He just scored against them for Crystal Palace. Didn't celebrate. Have a word with yourself. And Andros Townsend instead had a word with at Paul Lay 10. And he said, try 93 games and being there for 16 years from the age of 8 till 24. It's called a bit of respect to the club that made me, mate.
Ooh.
Wow.
I mean,
I got to say, I enjoyed that quite a bit.
What was the guy's
score
name?
Score one for Andros Townsend.
Paul Lay?
Paul Latham.
Paul Latham?
Yeah.
See, Paul made the mistake of not going back into the youth competitive Andros Townsend history book. Make sure you've got all your stats together. Remember when he first bought his Spurs shirt before you go to battle.
Andros Townsend, 16 years with Tottenham.
That is a chunk of change in someone's life.
It's a thing that has always, I think, been difficult for people in this country to wrap their minds around. Because when a guy leaves a team, it's almost like the opposite mentality is true here. Now I need to show them how wrong they were. It's different. I'll be honest, I kind of like the, like, paying your respect to the previous club. I enjoy it. It's very, like, honorable.
I'm thinking of American stars who absolutely would never, when they'd score a touchdown, like T.O. Imagine T.O.
Oh, my God.
He scores a touchdown in Philadelphia, and he just goes like this, no, calm down, calm, but flaps his hands. No, don't jump on me, don't celebrate, I want to show respect.
There's very few Adebayors. Remember when he scored against Arsenal and he just, like, sprinted.
Ocho Cinco and T.O. would totally understand Adebayor.
A quick what to watch for Tuesday, 3 o'clock, Newcastle and Manchester City. I worry for Newcastle. Man City have been in fine form. A nice little 5-0 win over Burnley in the FA Cup.
Newcastle are at home.
Wednesday.
That's going to make it tricky.
Wednesday, 3 o'clock, Liverpool and Leicester City. That's probably your marquee matchup, I think, of the... I don't know, the fixtures, they didn't really, like, jump off the page at me, to be honest, over the next couple days.
That's okay.
Yeah, I'm not blaming anyone. It's just the way it is. Coppa Italia quarterfinals. I'm looking at Wednesday, 2:45, AC Milan and Napoli. And Coppa del Rey quarterfinals, Wednesday, 3:30, Barcelona and Sevilla, with Barcelona going into the second leg down 2-0. So there you go. By the way, I forgot to mention the fifth round draw did come out for the FA Cup. And, boy, Manchester United are being run through the gamut. First they had Arsenal in the fourth round. Now they get Chelsea in the fifth. Manchester City are going to get either Middlesbrough or Newport County. So probably Middlesbrough, you'd have to say. So only two of the big six will make it into the next stage, which is interesting. And also either Wimbledon or Millwall will make it into the next stage because they play each other.
We shall talk about Millwall anon.
Anon meaning now, in this case.
Anon, goodness.
Red card.
Would you like to go first?
Yeah, why not? Millwall. Have we got the Millwall drop? Might as well do that as well.
Millwall.
That one?
Yeah. Well, once again, a terrific cup victory for Millwall Football Club has been overshadowed by violence prior to the game and racist chants inside the den during the game. That was, of course, their brilliant victory, let's be honest,
yeah,
over Everton. I listened to Millwall CEO Steve Kavanagh condemn the incidents, and it reminded me of a documentary made in 1977 about Millwall and its hooligan culture by the BBC TV show Panorama, which is basically the UK version of 60 Minutes. The most striking thing from this piece of audio is how over 40 years later, British football and society is dealing with the exact same problems. The first voice you will hear is Gordon Jago, manager of Millwall, condemning the fan violence that plagues the club. The second voice you will hear is that of Billy Plummer, 21-year-old and a self-confessed member of Millwall's hooligan gang. I can't remember if it was F Troop or Treatment. I'm not sure it matters. See if this sounds at all familiar.
No matter what I say when I meet them, and we've had get-togethers with them at supporters club meetings and so on, and you say, look, cut it out. We don't want that. You know, you're spoiling it for all of us. And unfortunately, you know, one cannot seem to change them. This is their attitude, and you know, we have to find ways and means of stopping it all.
What's he think he can do? Just turn around and say Merlin and say, all right, you lot ain't going to come down here.
But it's one club in
it. You never change Millwall. Same as you never change West Ham or you never change Chelsea. You'll always have
that. Every football club in the country's got hooligans.
It just seems so prescient. Jago comes on and he's this voice of reason. I want the club to be successful. We don't want hooliganism. And yet it is the voice of Billy Plummer that echoes through the ages, because you saw what was done to that poor Everton fan's face. Just slashed open before a game.
Well, you saw the video of like the brawl that took place outside of the stadium. I don't know. It's something that's just kind of like synonymous with that club.
Yeah, but he mentioned the other clubs as well, and that's kind of rung true as well, considering what's happened with Chelsea lately. Yeah. Scotland Yard said it was the worst fan violence in quite some time, which is just so depressing. By the way, it's worth watching that. That is on YouTube. Just type in Millwall 1977. And a lot of it talks about how they're going to deal with the arrival of newly relegated Spurs to come and play there, and how segregation is going to work, and what the Millwall fans will definitely be getting. It's almost accepted there will be this row. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's huge. And the other part of it is, which as echoes of today, is a member of the far-right group, the National Front, saying how they try to recruit at football young men at football grounds to join their racist, fascist organisation.
I don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
But it's very interesting. So I've been meaning to tell people about this forever, and unfortunately, Millwall gave me a reason. Yeah. So that's Millwall.
Let's see, my red card, JJ. Here's audio of Trevor Francis on BN Sports talking about Paul Pogba.
Oh, no.
Pogba, you know, for me, will never, ever give you the opportunity of winning trophies or championships, because I think he's a luxury player. He's not a Mourinho player.
Oh, God. If I had to guess, JJ, I'd say that Trevor Francis would want a do-over on that comment. If not a total do-over, at least an opportunity to rephrase it. Because it's hard to say that Pogba won't give you the opportunity of winning trophies or championships when he's been one of the best players on a Juventus team that won 4 Serie A's and 2 Coppa Italias, a Manchester United team that won a Europa League and an EFL Cup, and a French team that just won the World Cup, and he did all of this at or before turning 25 years old. Now, you can have your criticisms of Pogba, that he maybe wasn't worth what United paid for him, or that he has to be situated in a certain style in order to work, etc. We can have a conversation about those things, but JJ, I find it hard to look at what Pogba has achieved and question whether or not you can win with him. I think he has more than proven that you can do that.
Can I defend Trevor Francis for a second?
Sure.
Trevor Francis scored the winner in a European Cup final for Nottingham Forest. And months later, into the next season, Brian Clough went on the BBC and said how Trevor Francis hadn't achieved enough, hadn't done that much for a lad of 25. So I'm just wondering if his...
JJ, Paul Pogba just won a World Cup.
No, what I'm saying is Trevor Francis somehow channeling his
projecting his own...
From, because Brian Clough would have said, this is what he would have said about Paul Pogba.
What is crap? What bloody rubbish? Rubbish!
Nice man, that Brian Clough.
He went on and said, if we had everyone fit, the young man wouldn't have played against Malmo. He said that. And he hasn't represented his country that much. So he needs to do a lot better. This was his manager, so maybe he's so scared by that. That's the way he sees Pogba. Although Pogba has a haul of medals.
He's
enough
too
medals
many
to choke a horse.
It's honestly too many to ignore. It really is.
Caught Offside's man of the match.
What do you got?
Andrew, would you say that football is an ageist game? The game in general, does it mitigate against being if you're a little bit older?
Yeah.
You'd say it's an ageist game.
Yeah, I suppose.
Well, Cesar Menotti, the Argentinian to first claim a World Cup for his country as manager in 1978, has been put in charge of all international Argentinian football teams at the age of 80. Even more interesting is what Menotti had to say about those in charge of Argentinian soccer after they were eliminated by France in the round of 16 in the World Cup in July, and the AFA announced they were building a foreign training centre in Marbella, Spain. Marca reported that a WhatsApp message in which Menotti was full of rage over the opening of the property in Spain had been leaked. "I can't believe it. When I saw this, I started to feel bad. I wanted to grab a revolver and kill them. This is terrible. I am ashamed. It makes me want to go to hell to go live in Uruguay." Ooh, harsh on Uruguay and the Uruguay tourist board.
This is man of the match, right?
"This cannot be accepted. They spent a fortune in a property in Marbella. I spoke with a friend from Rosario and he told me that the clubs have no water. That central Cordoba was in the hands of four gangsters who bought this mansion because they say that the players are going to have to train there more than here. Who are the great players that Argentina have abroad that are not here?" That is a novel approach to getting any job. He said this last July and now he's been made the head honcho, probably the most powerful man in Argentinian soccer. And for all that, he just reminds me that in his pomp, in his heyday, with his long hair and his smoking, he looked like Iggy Pop.
I see the pictures.
There's Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
And there's Cesar Menotti.
I'm going to be honest. I'm always honest with you. This is easily your most fraudulent man of the match that you
have
ever
done. What
do you
mean? I think it's unbelievable that a man at 80...
You just spent 5 minutes talking about all the crazy things and backwards things that this guy has said.
No, he didn't say backwards things. He
did. What was the quote? "Who are the talented Argentinian players playing abroad?"
He was angry. It was in the...
Messi? I don't know. Where do we even begin?
No, but we had Roy Neymar from Mundo Abel Celeste talking about the mess, how players had to play for their own flights at the underage in Argentina,
and
right?
You're suggesting that this guy is going to fix it.
No, but he was right to be indignant about building a $2 million, whatever it is, facility in Spain. Put that money into the team here. But also, Andrew, have you ever got a job by in the interview going in and saying you're terrible at everything you do?
No.
I'm going to give that man, I like his style. He's got a job. He spoke his mind in the summer. And by the turn of the year, he's been made, just after the turn of the year, he's been made the head honcho.
I'd be curious to talk to Roy Neymar again and see what he thinks of this. I don't want to put words in his mouth. Let's see. My man of the match, JJ, young American soccer players in Germany. Paul Carr on Twitter over the weekend noted this. He said...
Statman Paul.
Yeah. "With Tyler Adams' debut today, 5 Americans under the age of 21 have played in the Bundesliga this season. Before the season, no more than 2 Americans under 21 had played in the same Bundesliga season. By the way, JJ, 4 of those players have scored goals this season. Can you name them?
Hadji Wright.
Yeah.
Weston McKennie.
Yeah.
Christian Pulisic.
Yeah.
And Josh Sargent.
There you go. And by all accounts, Adams was very good
in his debut.
His 72 touches were third most on the team. He had 3 tackles, 3 interceptions, led all players in the game with 7.3 miles covered.
Well, he will do that. He likes the jaunt.
Yeah,
let's
absolutely
put it that way.
Also, I learned on Paul Carr's Twitter feed that 8 Americans have scored in the Bundesliga this season, breaking the record of 7 from back in 2016-17. We already named the 4. Can you name the other 4 that have scored this year?
There's... whose name, and you know his name always.
Alfredo Morales.
Yes, okay. At Fortuna Dusseldorf.
Yeah.
He got one.
Yep.
Who else scored in the Bundesliga?
I'm trying to think of hints that I could give you. We mentioned 2 of these names earlier
Brooks,
in the show. Yes.
He had a header, didn't he? Fabian Johnson, he scored earlier in the season.
The last one is a player that you might not think of because it feels like whenever he's referenced... in reference with Bundesliga, it's always kind of like he's kind of maligned, But he is a striker.
And he's still there as well.
Yeah.
And he's kind of, and I can see his face, and he's on his way back. There's talk of him coming back to MLS. Tell me his name. I forgot.
Bobby Wood?
Bobby Wood.
Okay. There's talk about him coming back?
There was talk, but I'm sure it's dissipated.
Yeah, well, there you go. And, so it was a good weekend for young American soccer players in Germany. So
yeah.
There you go. Hey, this was fun, my friend. I finished Man in the High Castle. I don't really know what to go home and watch now, although you told me the Fire Festival documentary.
Fire Festival is unbelievable. Yeah. By the way, to answer the question from last week, Fire Festival is not Everton. It is Leeds United.
Okay.
Towards the end when they were just spending money, spending money on the hope that things would turn out all right, and they didn't.
We will be back on Wednesday to look at the midweek matches in the Premier League, also to see if Barcelona can overturn that two-goal deficit against Sevilla. Hey, this was fun. To you, I say...
Take you later, fun boy.
I'll see you.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.